I'm very glad to be here being with you. Share my knowledge of Abhidharma with you, and I'm grateful to, I don't remember the sponsors, so who made it possible to teach this class in Theravada tradition. Whenever an author writes a book, he first pays homage to the Triple Gem and also to his teachers. And today I'm very glad that all of you paid homage to the Triple Gem. So the aim of paying homage to the Triple Gem at the beginning of a class or at the beginning of writing a book is for the task to have a successful end without hindrance. So we hope to finish this class without any hindrance. Years ago, I was reading a book, a small paperback, and the name of that book was Sea Without Glasses. This book contains some exercises for your for the eye muscles, so as to correct the vision, so that you can read without glasses. The exercises given in that book were so involved that I gave up. That is why I am still wearing glasses today. But what struck me, that book struck me, was some statement in that book. In one place, that book said, seeing is 90% mental and only 10% physical. Now, that book was written by an MD. MD means medical doctor. So when I read this, I was very surprised, because it came very close to what was taught in Abhidharma. Now, according to Abhidharma, seeing is more mental than physical. Now, it is true that the eyes and the object to be seen play some part in seeing, but seeing consists of a great amount of mental activity, and these mental activities are explained in detail in Abhidharma. And in another place, the book said, in order for you to see the letter A, your eyes shift 4 times. So only after shifting 4 times do you see the letter A. That also comes very close to what was taught in Abhidharma. According to Abhidharma, in order to say, I see a man, or I see a woman, your mind has to go through 5 types of thought processes, and each thought process repeating thousands of times. So only after going through these 5 classes or 5 types of thought process do you see a man or a woman. So it comes very close to what was taught in Abhidharma. So quite often we find some parallels in science, modern science, and the Abhidhamma. And also in the Reader's Digest magazine, I read a sentence. It was actually the end of article filler. And that sentence is, if we take out all space from the earth, from the globe, the earth would be no bigger than a golf ball. Unbelievable. It is what is said in the book. And it also came very close to what was taught in Abhidhamma. So according to Abhidhamma, the material properties arise and exist in groups. And between these groups, there is always space. And there are many small particles of material properties existing close to each other, but there is always space between these groups of material properties. So although we think that, for example, this thing is solid, actually it is like a sieve. And there is much space in this stand. So again, it comes very close to what was taught in Abhidhamma. And lately, I saw in an advertisement one statement. Now, in Abhidhamma, it is taught that the mind or consciousness can arise and disappear billions of times in a second. What was said in the books is, in a time when you snap your fingers, billions of thought moments can arise and disappear. Although we have been teaching this for many years, we have no way of proving it until this nuclear science came into being. Now, there are now produced watches that set themselves taking the time signals broadcast by one station. Now, that station is located in the state of Colorado in the USA. So that state is called the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And it is said in this advertisement that to an ordinary person, a second means just a tick, tick of a clock. What is a second for us? Just the tick, tick of a clock. But to the nuclear scientists at that center, it is a second is 9+ billion vibrations of a cesium-133 atom in a vacuum. Now, I don't know about the atoms, but what struck me was saying more than 9 billion vibrations in a second. If they can calculate 900 billion vibrations in a second, that means mind can arise, and the consciousness of mind can arise and disappear billions of times in a second. So that also comes very close to what is taught in Abhidhamma. So there are many things in Abhidhamma that are very interesting, and that has parallels in modern science. Now I'm a Buddhist monk, and so I do not use modern science as the touchstone to test Buddhism on it. So my attitude is the other way around. So I will take the teachings of the Buddha as the touchstone and test science on it. And if science does not agree with what the Buddha taught, I will wait for a time when it agrees with what the Buddha taught. So in Dhiruma there are many things that are interesting. It is like a storehouse, a big storehouse of these things, waiting to be explored, waiting to be understood by people like you. So I'm very glad that today I'm told that there are about 200 participants at this class, and this is the biggest class I've ever taught. Nowadays, there are two divisions of Buddhism, two major divisions of Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism and Theravada Buddhism. Now we have parted from each other, but we still are brothers. But we have different teachings that are common to both these branches, and also we have some different sutras. Now there is Abhidhamma in Mahayana and there is Abhidhamma in Theravada. They are not exactly the same. Now, since I am a Theravada Buddhist monk, I am familiar with Theravada Abhidhamma, and so the Abhidhamma I am going to teach you in this class is Theravada Abhidhamma. And we need to know how the Buddha's teachings are recorded and handed down until the present time. So it is a little bit of history, how these teachings were handed down. Now we now have what are called three pitakas or three baskets, and Abhidhamma is the third of these baskets. And we need to know how these teachings were handed down from generation to generation. Now Buddha did not write anything down. There were no books, or books were very difficult to get in those days. And also maybe people at that time thought that Buddha's teachings were so sacred that they should not be put on books or writing materials, whatever. So Buddha's teachings were remembered by his immediate disciples, or memorized. His teachings were memorized by his immediate disciples. And after the death of the Buddha, only 3 months after his death, the surviving disciples, headed by the Venerable Mahakasapa, decided to hold a council, a Buddhist council. So at this Buddhist council, all the teachings of the Buddha were collected. And 2 venerable monks presented the teachings of the Buddha to the council. And each unit of teaching, or each saying, was closely scrutinized. And when the participants of that council, there were 500 arahants at that council, so when and all immediate disciples of the Buddha, so when the participants were satisfied that a piece of teaching was the authentic teaching of the Buddha, they accepted that teaching by reciting together. So reciting together is a kind of seal of authenticity for that particular teaching. So in this way, every piece of teaching was closely scrutinized, and then when they were satisfied, they accepted that teaching by reciting together. So the Pali word for that kind of ceremony is called Sangayana or Sangiti, meaning reciting together. So at the first Buddhist council, all the teachings of the Buddha were collected and invited into three pitikas of basket, and later and also into five nikayas or collections, and we will come to them later. So 3 months after the death of the Buddha, the first council was held, and at that council all the teachings of the Buddha were collected and accepted. Then 100 years after the death of the Buddha, there was another council. So at that council also, those that were accepted at the first Buddhist council were reaffirmed and reaccepted. And then these teachings were handed down from generation to generation by word of mouth. 234 years after the death of the Buddha, during the time of King Asoka at Pataliputra in India, the third Buddhist council was held. At that council also, the teachings that were accepted at the first and the second councils were reaffirmed and accepted. Now, until that time, Buddha's teachings were handed down from generation to generation by word of mouth. After the Third Buddhist Council, the Venerable Moggaliputta Thesa, who was the president of that council, with the help of King Asoka, sent missionaries to different countries. And one group of missionaries was sent to Sri Lanka. And that missionary was very successful, and the whole of the island became Buddhist. And the Tipitaka was brought to Sri Lanka, and then monks in Sri Lanka wrote commentaries also. But about 450 years after the death of the Buddha, there was a great rebellion in Sri Lanka. People had to flee their places, and monks also could not live in their places, and so they have to go here and there. Some went into the forest and so on. And so the country was all in disorder. So when that happened, one group of monks decided to go to South India to escape the rebellion. But there were other monks who chose to remain in Sri Lanka, although they had very different times and different conditions. They tried to keep the Tipitaka intact in their memory. They may not have enough to eat, but they recited the Tipitaka so that they do not forget. And that rebellion lasted for 12 years. After 12 years, when the rebellion was over, the monks who went over to South India came back to Sri Lanka. So when they came back, those who are left behind in Sri Lanka said, brothers, you went over to South India and you did not suffer like we did. But we suffered a lot during the rebellion, and so our memory might have been impaired. We may have made some mistakes in our memory. So let us check the Tipitaka you have memorized with our Tipitaka, which we have memorized. So when they checked, when the two parties checked the Tipitaka they had memorized, it was said that there was no difference. So they decided that in the future people might not be able to memorize all these and hold them together, and so they decided to write down the Tipitaka on palm leaves. So that took place about 450 years after the death of the Buddha, and that was done in Sri Lanka in a place called Aluwihara near the city of Kandy. Then in 1871 another Buddhist council took place in Myanmar in the city of Mandalay during the time of King Mindon. So King Mindon was a very devout king, and he wanted to do what other kings had not done. He knew that Tipitaka was written on palm leaves. Now he wanted the Tipitaka to last forever. So he decided to have Tipitaka inscribed on marble slabs. And it was lucky that there was a hill near Mandalay where these marble slabs can be obtained. You have seen many marble Buddha statues. You know how good they are. So the Tipitaka was inscribed on those marble slabs, and there were altogether 729 marble slabs, and they are still intact. They are still to be seen in Mandalay, even though there was fighting during the Second World War around that place. None of these slabs were hit by any bombshell or whatever. So until today, they stand intact in the compound of a pagoda near Mandalay Hill. Now that was in 1871. And then in 1954, after the independence, another council was held, and it was called the Sixth Buddhist Council. To that council, all the representatives of all Theravada countries were invited, and also prominent leaders from the Mahayana countries were also invited. And 2,500 monks participated in that council in a man-made cave near Rangoon. So that was held in 1954, and it went on for about 6 or 7 years. So the Tipitaka was handed down from generation to generation through the councils. Until the Fifth Council, there were no printed books in Burma or in Myanmar. But later, under the British rule, the Tipitaka books were printed. And so at the Sixth Buddhist Council, all these Tipitaka books along with the commentaries, and sub-commentaries were edited and published. So now the Myanmar people have the whole set of Tipitaka complete with commentaries and sub-commentaries. Now Buddha's teachings are divided into Nikayas and also into Pitakas. Now I want you to be familiar with these two divisions. So at the first Buddhist council, the elders divided the Buddha's teachings into five collections or Nikayas, and they are collection of long discourses, collection of middle length discourses, collection of kindred discourses or associated discourses, collection of gradual discourses, and collection of minor discourses. Now they are respectively called in Pali Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and Kodaka Nikaya. So Buddha's teachings were divided into five collections. That is one division. Another division is into three Pitakas or baskets. Now the word Pitaka in Pali means baskets or things to be learned. And these three Pitakas are Vinaya Pitaka, Sutta or Suttanta Pitaka, and Abhidhamma Pitaka. So all teachings of the Buddha were divided into five Nikayas, and also they are divided into three Pitakas. Now the division into Nikayas is not a subdivision of Pitaka division. It is a separate division. I tell you this because there is so much misunderstanding about Nikayas and Pitakas. Many people think that Digha Nikaya and so on are a subdivision of Sutta Pitaka, but that is not true. The Nikaya division is one division and Pitaka division is another independent division. Among the five collections or five Nikayas, Abhidhamma is included in the minor discourses. But in the three Pitakas, Abhidhamma Pitaka is one separate Pitaka. Okay, now we come to the word Abhidhamma. The word Abhidhamma composed of Abhi and Dhamma. Abhi is a prefix. Here it means excelling or distinguished, and Dhamma means teaching. So Abhidhamma means the teaching excelling or distinguished from the teachings in Sutta Pitaka. And that means they excel or they are distinguished from the teachings in Sutta Pitaka with regard to method of treatment. When we say Abhidhamma is the excelling teaching or distinguished teaching from the teachings of Sutta Pitaka, we do not mean that those that are taught in Abhidhamma Pitaka are better than or higher than those taught in Sutta Pitaka. They are called excellent or distinguished because of the method of treatment. Many topics were taught both in Sutta Pitaka and Abhidhamma Pitaka. But what makes Abhidhamma Pitaka different from Sutta Pitaka is its method of treatment. Now, you are all familiar with five aggregates. Now, these five aggregates are treated in brief in the Sutta Pitaka. in the Vidyagaka Sanyukta Nikaya, the five aggregates are taught in brief, and it occupies only one page. But these same five aggregates were treated in Abhidhamma, following the methods of Sotanta method, Abhidhamma method, and method of questions and answers. And it occupies 68 pages in the second book of Abhidhamma. So the treatment, method of treatment is very different. In Sotanta Vidyaka, the treatment is very brief. But in Abhidhamma Vidyaka, these five aggregates are treated in full, according to the Sotanta method, according to Abhidhamma method, and according to the method of questions and answers. And so it takes 68 pages to explain the five aggregates in Abhidhamma. Now, what are taught in Abhidhamma? One ultimate teaching in contrast to conventional teaching in Sotanta Vidyaka. In Sotanta Vidyaka, Buddha used conventional terms. Buddha used a person, man, woman, I, you, and so on. But in Abhidhamma Vidyaka, Buddha mostly used the terms of reality, not conventional terms, but the terms of reality like consciousness, mental factors, material properties, and so on. And the realities are expounded in many different ways. So mind is minutely analyzed. And also matter analyzed in very detail. Mind is divided into citta or consciousness and chetasikas or mental factors. And matter is also treated in full, giving the list of matters and then their causes, how they are grouped and how they arise and disappear in one life and so on. So, in Abhidhamma, what are called realities are expounded in many different ways. They are divided, they are analyzed into minute detail. So mind is divided into first citta and chetasikas, and then citta is divided into 89 or 121 types, and chetasikas are 52, and so on. So it is very analytical and it goes into great details. And mostly the conventional terms are avoided in the Abhidhamma Vidyaka. So in the Abhidhamma Vidyaka you find the terms like consciousness, mental factors, and so on, rather than man, woman, individual, I, you, and so on. Now, people ask whether Abhidhamma is philosophy or what. Now, Abhidhamma is said to be a philosophy because it deals with the most general causes and principles that govern all things. It can be called philosophy because it deals with reality. So what are real entities? And it is also called an ethical system because it enables one to realize the ultimate goal, Nibbana. Actually, there is not much of ethics in Abhidhamma. When we say we can find some ethics in Abhidhamma, we must understand ethics in a broader sense, not in its narrow sense of a set of moral rules or moral precepts. We say there is some kind of ethics in Abhidhamma, because when consciousness is explained, consciousness is divided into wholesome consciousness, unwholesome consciousness, and neither wholesome nor unwholesome consciousness. So wholesome consciousness we may call good consciousness, and unwholesome consciousness, bad consciousness. So since consciousness are divided into wholesome, unwholesome, and neutral, we can say that there is a little of ethics in Abhidhamma. And because it deals with the working of the mind, with thought processes and mental factors, it is also a system of psychology. Now it is, I think it is more psychology than ethics or philosophy, because it deals with working of the mind, how mind works, and then thought processes and mental factors arising together with in the different types of consciousness, and how they are related, consciousness to consciousness, consciousness to mental factors, consciousness to material properties, and so on. So, Searo Utitila, a well-known Myanmar Searo, wrote in the book called The Path of the Buddha. It is a philosophy in as much as it deals with the most general causes and principles that govern all things. It is also an ethical system because it enables one to realize the ultimate goal, Nibbana, and because it deals with the working of the mind, with thought processes and mental factors. It is also a system of psychology. Abhidhamma is therefore generally translated as psychoethical philosophy of Buddhism. So of these three things put together. Now, we come to the importance of Abhidhamma. Many people ask, is Abhidhamma necessary, or is Abhidhamma essential? Now, Abhidhamma is essential for correct and thorough understanding of Buddha's teachings. Without knowledge of Abhidhamma, we do not understand the teachings even in the Sutta Pitaka. Our understanding may be erroneous, or our understanding may not be complete. So it is important for the correct and thorough understanding of the Buddha's teachings, even in the Sutta. Now, there are people who think that Abhidhamma is not necessary. So we can live without Abhidhamma, even if we do not study Abhidhamma, our understanding of the Buddha's teachings will not be incomplete or something like that. But actually, without the knowledge of Abhidhamma, it is very difficult to correctly understand the teachings in the Sutta Pitaka. Now let us take the example of the first verse in the book called Dhammapada. Now I hope you all have read the book Dhammapada. Now the very first verse and the very first line or the very first foot of that verse runs in Pali as Mano Pubbangama Dhamma. How do you remember that translation? There are many English translations of Dhammapada, and they are not the same. They each one differ from another one. There are the word Manopubhangama Dhamma. If you do not understand Abhidhamma, it is difficult to understand the word Dhamma there. What does Dhamma stand for in that verse? And then what is Mano there? And Upangama means forerunner. So I will translate using Pali words. Dhammas are those that have Mano as their forerunner. That is the literal translation of that thought. That means Dhammas have Mano as their forerunner. Here, Dhamma does not mean everything in the world. Here, Dhamma means just the mental aggregate. And Mano is another mental aggregate called consciousness. So, this means consciousness is the forerunner of the other mental states. We are not to understand that mind is a forerunner of everything in the world. Mind is a forerunner of mental states. That means consciousness is the chief of all mental states. If consciousness does not arise, the other mental states cannot arise. That is why it is called a forerunner. Here, forerunner does not mean that consciousness arises first and then mental states arise later and follow it. Because they arise at the same time. The consciousness and mental factors arise at the same time. But consciousness is called the forerunner of these mental states, simply because without consciousness, other mental states cannot arise. So we must understand that way, and that you can understand only you know Abhidhamma. Now, some translations are quite far from the original Pali, so that they are not translations at all, maybe interpretations. In this book, some translations are given. Things are forerun by mind. That is one translation. Not so bad. But the next one, the mental natures are the result of what we have thought. That's quite different from what the original Pali means. And then the next one, all that we are is the result of what we have thought. Although it is not alien to Buddhism, it is not the meaning conveyed by the word Manopubhangama Dhamma. So, some translators were aware of the commentary explanation, but they just ignore it and they translate it as they like. So without the knowledge of Abhidhamma, even that one sentence we cannot understand properly. Again, in the Dhammapada, there is a verse which says, all fear the rod. All fear death. Now, that also, if we do not understand Abhidhamma, we may misunderstand that. All tremble at the rod. That means all tremble at the stick. All fear death. Now, according to Abhidhamma, arahants and bodhas are those who have eradicated all mental defilements. Since they have no mental defilements in their minds, there is no attachment in their mind, there is no fear in their mind, no anger in their mind. So although the verse says all fear death, we must understand all does not mean all. All except Buddhas and Arahants. In the next verse also, there is a saying, life is dear to all. That means everybody is attached to his life. That all also is not all, because Arahants and Buddhas are not attached to their lives because they have eradicated mental defilements altogether. No attachment, no anger, and so on. So, although the words used are all, we must understand that all means all except Arahants and Buddhas. So these are small things, but you know, if you do not understand Abhidhamma, you may misunderstand this, and you may say, now here it is said that everybody is afraid of death, and so Buddha must be also afraid of death. And another verse is that verse you already know. Not to do any evil, to cultivate good, to purify your mind, and this is the teaching of Buddha. But in order not to do evil, we must understand what evil is. If we don't understand what evil is, how can we avoid doing evil? And evil, the English word evil here is, I think, too strong. Because even when you are eating, you are enjoying your meal, you are eating, there is evil, there is unwholesome mental state. If you eat with attachment, then there is unwholesome mental state in you, and that is also called evil. In Pali it is called papa. It may not be too bad, but still it is evil. So if we are to follow the advice of the Buddha, we must eat so that we are not attached to food. And that we do by applying mindfulness to the activities involved in the act of eating, or to reflect on food as, say, I eat food just to be able to practice the Dharma and not to take pride in myself, and so on. So, in order to avoid evil, first we must understand what evil is. And this you can understand only through Abhidhamma. Okay, another one. You all are familiar with the six attributes of the Dharma. Svakhato, Bhagavata, Dhammo, and so on. So there is one word, Akaliko. And Akaliko is translated as not delayed or giving immediate results. Kala here means time, and time means time to give results. So Akaliko means there is no time for giving results. That means it does not delay in giving results, it gives immediate results. And in order to understand it, you need to understand Abhidhamma. In Abhidhamma it is taught that at the moment of enlightenment, a type of consciousness arises, and that consciousness is called Magga, path consciousness. And that path consciousness is immediately followed by fruition consciousness, two or three moments of fruition consciousness. So Magga is the cause, and fruition is the effect. So here, the maga gives its fruit immediately without any intervention of time. So that is why it is called akaliko, no time. Sometimes akalika is translated as timeless. So if we translate it as timeless, we may mean some other thing. It is eternal or something like that. But the word akaliko here means that it has no time, delay time in giving results. And you can understand the immediate results only when you know Abhidhamma. So there are many places in the Sutta Pitaka where you may not understand or you may understand wrongly if you do not know Abhidhamma. Another one. You are all familiar with the Four Noble Truths. The first noble truth is the noble truth of suffering. So when explaining the noble truth of suffering, Buddha said, birth is suffering, old age is suffering, death, disease is suffering, death is suffering, and so on. And at the end, what did Buddha say? In brief, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Now, how do you understand aggregates? How do you understand clinging? And how do you understand aggregates of clinging? Without the knowledge of Abhidhamma, you don't understand that. Here, aggregates of clinging means aggregates that are the object of clinging. Now, that is one meaning. Aggregates that are the object of clinging. Then what is clinging? In Abhidhamma, it is taught that there are four kinds of clinging, and in reality there are two, the attachment or craving and wrong view. So those that can be the object of craving and wrong view are called aggregates of clinging. And there are five of them. So the Buddha said, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. Since it is called five aggregates of clinging, there must be five aggregates of not clinging also. So, five aggregates and five aggregates of clinging. This you understand only with reference to Abhidhamma. So when you understand Abhidhamma, you know what these five aggregates of clinging are. It is important to understand the five aggregates of clinging, because when you practice vipassana meditation, you take any of the five aggregates of clinging as object, and you do not take aggregates that are not the object of clinging as object. So with reference to akalika, we talk about magga, or path consciousness. Now, path consciousness and its result, fruition consciousness, are not the object of clinging. They are outside the range of clinging. So, when you practice vipassana, you cannot take path consciousness as object, because if you practice vipassana, you take the aggregates of clinging as object. So it is important that you understand Abhidhamma to understand this. So there are many, many more places in the Sutta Pitaka where you need the knowledge of Abhidhamma. But still there are some people who say, we don't need Abhidhamma. Now, Sera Uditila again said in the same book, Abhidhamma is highly prized by the profound students of Buddhist philosophy. But to the average student, it seems to be dull and meaningless. This is because it is so extremely subtle in its analysis and technical in its treatment that it is very difficult to understand without the guidance of an able teacher. That is probably why the Abhidhamma is not so popular as the other two Pitakas among Western Buddhists. Now, Abhidhamma Pitaka cannot be read without the basic knowledge. I cannot pick up a book on higher mathematics and read it and understand it because I don't have the basic knowledge of mathematics. So first, I must understand the basics of mathematics to be able to read a book on higher mathematics. In the same way, you cannot pick up a book on Abhidhamma and read it and understand it. That is impossible. So in order to understand the books of Abhidhamma, first you need to have the basic or fundamentals, basic knowledge or the knowledge of the fundamentals of Abhidhamma. So that is why Abhidhamma is not so popular, because people may have picked up a real Abhidhamma book and read it, and then after two pages they will put it down. So you need the basic knowledge of Abhidhamma, and what you will be studying at this class is not Abhidhamma, but the fundamentals of Abhidhamma, or basics of Abhidhamma, so that after understanding the basics, you can go into the real treasure house of Abhidhamma with ease. Now, the other question. Is Abhidhamma necessary or essential to gain enlightenment or to be successful in the practice of meditation? Now, knowledge of Abhidhamma is not absolutely essential for the realization of truth or for attaining enlightenment. But it is extremely helpful to those who practice meditation. Now, if you understand Abhidhamma and practice meditation, it is like reading a guidebook before you visit a place. You may visit a place without reading a guidebook. But if you have read a book, a guidebook on the place you are going to visit, and then you visit it later, you know many things about that place. You don't have to be told this is this or this is this. So when you have a knowledge of Abhidhamma and you practice meditation, what you experience, you can identify. You don't have to ask another person what your experience is. So, a knowledge of Abhidhamma is like knowledge of a place before you visit that place. So, that is why knowledge of Abhidhamma is helpful for those who practice meditation. But, we do not say that it is absolutely essential or you must know Abhidhamma before you can practice meditation, because there are many stories and during the time of the Buddha that shows that without the knowledge of Abhidhamma you can practice meditation and attain enlightenment. So two questions: is Abhidhamma necessary or essential for the understanding of the teachings of the Buddha? The answer is yes, it is essential for correct understanding of the teachings of the Buddha. Is it essential for the realization of truth? No. But if you have knowledge of Abhidhamma, it will help you a great deal. So anyway, knowledge of Abhidhamma is beneficial those who know who know it, or who possess it. We'll have a short break.